Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to the Daily Sunup. The Daily Sunup podcast is a conversation with the Colorado Sun. See our trust indicators at coloradosun.com/ethics. It's Friday, April 26th. Today, we're talking to historian, author, and outdoor enthusiast Rachel S. Gross about her new book, Shopping All the Way to the Woods: How the Outdoor Industry Sold Nature to America. Before we begin, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Pinnacle Assurance, Colorado's leading provider of workers' compensation insurance. Pinnacle provides caring protection that Colorado businesses can rely on as they expand across the country. From finance to robotics and Arizona to Orlando, Pinnacle's nationwide coverage goes wherever Colorado businesses grow. Now, let's go back in time with some Colorado history. On this day in 1951, President Harry Truman expanded Hovenweep National Monument in southwestern Colorado by assigning two additional tracts of federal land to the area. These lands included the Hackberry and Goodman Point ruins, preserving more of the region's preeminent prehistoric masonry. The Four Corners region, initially home to hunter-gatherers, saw permanent settlements from around 900 AD. Ancestral Puebloans later built extensive stone structures and practiced irrigated agriculture, supporting a peak population of about 2,500. Drought and resource scarcity eventually led to the abandonment of these settlements around the early 1300s. Hovenweep's remarkable ruins attracted American explorers from 1854 onwards and achieved formal protection by 1923 under President Warren Harding. Before we continue, Next 50's vision is a world that values aging. By 2034, older adults will outnumber children for the first time ever. Next 50 funds innovative programs that combat age bias, advance digital equity, and make it possible to age where you want to live. Explore more at next50foundation.org. Next, our feature story.
I'm Tracy Ross, a reporter at the Colorado Sun, and joining me today is Rachel S. Gross, who is featured in this week's Sunlit feature. Rachel is a historian of the outdoor industry and author of Shopping All the Way to the Woods: How the Outdoor Industry Sold Nature to America. It was published by Yale University Press. It came out in March. And Rachel is an assistant professor of history at the University of Colorado Denver, where she teaches U.S. environmental, business, and public history. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you.
How's it going?
Great. I'm happy to be here, and I'm enjoying the spring weather.
So you have a very cool name. You're not related to Terry Gross, are you?
I wish. I would like to claim that connection, but I don't know that she'd recognize me as a relative.
Okay. So yeah, your name is Rachel S. Gross, and you were just telling me a minute ago why you like to include the S in your name.
Yeah, there are a number of other Rachel Gross historians whose work, you know, in different fields that you should also check out. We're a good cohort, the bunch of us.
Excellent. Well, why don't you give our readers a quick synopsis of your book, and then we'll dive into some questions.
Shopping All the Way to the Woods asks the question, why do Americans, if they're trying to escape out to wild nature, spend so much of their time and their hard-earned money going shopping for outdoor clothing and equipment? The book traces the history of gear and clothing from the Civil War to the present, looking at the changes in technology and design. But more importantly, it looks at how Americans acquired goods as a way of expressing their outdoor identity. So it's a book for gear lovers, I would say, written by a gear lover herself, interested in kind of how products can be a window into understanding kind of meanings people attach to the goods that they buy.
It's such a fascinating topic. You mentioned in the intro of the book that you are a historian of outdoor gear, and also that you're the first person to claim such a job description. I absolutely love this, but I also wonder, why do you think no one has taken a deep dive into the history of outdoor gear before you?
I think there are a few different reasons, and one has to do with the fact that it's so much fun that academic historians perhaps have been interested in these questions but not deemed it serious enough or important enough to do the work. And I was lucky enough to have guidance from other very smart professors who suggested this is a topic kind of well worthy of serious inquiry. I think the other reason has to do with the maturation of the outdoor industry overall. There are a number of people kind of involved in preserving the history of the industry of individual companies, as well as the industry more broadly nationwide, that have popped up in the last decade, speaking to an expanding interest in the history and recognizing that if we don't preserve a lot of these stories, capture them through oral history interviews or collecting objects or written records, that those histories will be lost. But that wasn't the case 10 years ago when many of the people who were involved in the founding of well-known outdoor companies were still actively participating in the work. And now that many of them have retired or passed away, people are recognizing, these stories are at risk and they are really important to preserve. So I think this work is a part of a much broader trend where people are recognizing not just the kind of the expedience of doing this work now, but also that collecting this history can really capture the broad cultural and political power of the industry.
It is such a powerful industry, too. What is the most recent stat on that?
Yeah, lots of stats to throw around here, but I think the latest I heard is that the Americans spend around 2.2% of GDP each year on outdoor recreation in some form. And so that's just one important number that reflects kind of the deep investment we have in outdoor recreation, but also kind of how broad the infrastructure is around the country.
Super interesting. Well, I, you know, personally, growing up in the outdoors in Idaho, you know, my family were, we skied and we backpacked, but we weren't like hardcore outdoor people. And yet I feel like the Patagonia catalog shaped the core of my identity. And it's been so interesting watching that company over the last 40 years. And one question that I have, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself here, but I've been dying to ask you this, is shouldn't these companies that keep creating all of this stuff for us to buy, whether we need it or not, to go into the outdoors? I mean, with a company like Patagonia, wouldn't the smartest thing be for them just to close their doors and stop creating and producing things?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a question that, you know, that Patagonia, of all kind of companies that we'll probably talk about, is really grappling with, right? And the well-known kind of ad from 2012 that ran on Black Friday that Patagonia ran on Don't Buy This Jacket kind of reflected that concern from the inside about the perpetuation of a culture of consumerism and the impact on the global environment when people keep buying more goods than they actually need. So I think that's a real question. It's not one that this book answers directly, right? But it's where all the conversations go in the end, because what people really want to know is, like, is there a better product I can buy? You know, how do I do my part and not harm the wild nature that I love so much while still being able to access it using these products? And I agree with you. The answer ultimately is kind of cutting back on our love for buying stuff, right? The acquisition of goods is ultimately a culture kind of that butts up against kind of deeply held kind of environmentalist values. And I don't necessarily see companies themselves having the answers to this question, right? So, yes, logically speaking, they might shut their doors. I don't think practically speaking that's realistic. And so instead, I think we have to kind of pay attention to how the conversation about environmental values has evolved within the industry, and also when to look beyond companies, right, to other forms of solutions.
Yeah, great. Well, let's back up. And your book spends quite a bit of time on one particular item, and that is the buckskin jacket. And you talk about Theodore Roosevelt, you talk about this aesthetic way back in the, you know, late 1800s, sort of when people and men in particular started, you know, really becoming attracted, I would say, to this idea of being rugged outdoors people. And the buckskin jacket played into that in such significant ways. Can you kind of tell us about that? Because it's such an important piece of your book.
It is. And it's a funny one as well, I think, in some ways. The most important kind of idea that the buckskin jacket represents is this notion of making things yourself from kind of nature's kind of offerings. This is the woodcraft ethic of the late 19th century that guidebooks and outdoors people promulgated and kind of tried to recreate by making their own buckskin jackets, pants, and other items. The idea was that outdoorsmen, if they were going to do the outdoors the right way, if they were truly rugged, authentic experts, would know how to kill a deer, skin it, and kind of tan the hide to prepare to make these clothes. The trick here, part of what's funny about this story, though, is that many men actually didn't know how to do this, right? Though guidebooks were saying, don't buy this, you must make it yourself, guidebook authors were actually buying it from Native American women who did have the expertise to make this. And Teddy Roosevelt, perhaps the most famous kind of person who ever posed in a buckskin jacket, you know, his image from a New York studio was published in one of his books and, you know, sent all around the world in some ways. Teddy Roosevelt also didn't make his own buckskin jacket. And so the buckskin idea kind of both represents this ideal of woodcraft, of making things yourself using nature as a storehouse, and also kind of the contradictions inherent in that when so few people could live up to that ideal.
Yeah. And can you tell us a little more about the Native American women piece? Because this is also a story of equity, isn't it? And sort of the whitewashing and the lies that we continue to tell ourselves about our history and how we became experts at such things.
Readers and listeners who know about kind of histories of the American West will recognize kind of the rhetoric around kind of that late 19th century white Americans use when positioning Native peoples as kind of naturally going to disappear, right? Suggesting that there would be a so-called last Indian and that it was white men who would replace them in their spread westward. It is that kind of imperial idea that shaped outdoors people's attitudes towards kind of expertise in the woods. They expected that they, through their buckskin suits that they purchased from Native people, would kind of use the expertise that Native Americans represented when it came to outdoor skill and be the ones to kind of take over those physical spaces out in the wild as Native American presence gradually receded into the ledgers of history. What that represents, though, is a real kind of imperialist ideal of kind of white supremacy and the notion that Native peoples only can exist in the past, not in the American present. And so I think, again, the buckskin suit and the way that white men often talked about making themselves what they in fact purchased quite consciously from Native women reflects this idea of kind of mistelling the American past to present white men as more rugged and individual and independent than in fact they were, and as not just kind of passively occupying space that Native people had once been in, but really actively being a part of that conquest, even if they were there for recreational purposes.
So fascinating. I love how you write about, you know, women consumers at that time and a little bit later also, and how they, of course, like we still are, or we're like kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place in terms of femininity and who they were supposed to be and who they were supposed to portray themselves as being. And I just find, you know, somebody who's like deeply entrenched in the outdoors, sometimes I think we're still grappling with that. But tell the readers a little bit about that whole problem with being a woman, you know, in the 20s, 30s, 40s and wanting to be an outdoors person.
So, like, one important myth this book dispels is that women were not a part of outdoor recreation, either on the industry side or on the consumer participation side, since the earliest days. That, of course, isn't true. Women very much had a presence. And we know that in part because we can see in kind of early outdoor companies like Abercrombie and Fitch at its New York headquarters had an entire floor dedicated to the outdoor woman where she could shop for the clothes she would take to the woods to go camping or fishing. The challenge that you're describing, though, is one about how to appropriately perform femininity while still wanting to actively participate in these really fun activities. women found themselves kind of yearning for functional outerwear, but feeling that they also needed to cover up their bodies to not show their legs, perhaps, to carry a skirt that they could quickly wrap around themselves should they encounter someone beyond their own party out on the trail. And it's this kind of challenge that makes the woods not an escape, but really an extension of the same kind of, you know, social norms that exist within cities. And women often were pushing at the boundaries of the sport, as well as at the boundaries of fashion or style, to expand opportunities for themselves. But the messaging from companies in the catalogs and the imagery around outdoor sports often kind of repeated these notions of women only having a kind of a limited space and a limited type of aesthetic or appearance within that space.
It's crazy. And not to keep talking about women, although why not? You know, as we move forward in history, I'm just thinking back to who my sort of idols were when I was younger. And, you know, they were Lynn Hill and people like her, Aunt Catherine d'Estaville, right? She was the other big climber at the time. And I just remember them still being like, kind of like sexy, and, you know, in like very short shorts and stuff like that. And I think part of it was like, that's what you wear when you go climbing. But how have we progressed as women and as we view women in the outdoors, you know, through this lens of of gear and clothing over the last 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 years?
Sure. Yeah. So the era that you're describing, I think a lot of other readers recognize that as women started to be more represented in outdoor company catalogs, that the first way that they appeared was as sexual objects. And this was an issue of great concern to both men and women alike who are consuming these catalogs, you know, like flipping through the pages and encountering like a coyish smile of a woman who appears to be naked under a sleeping bag was not actually what they were looking for or hoping for, you know, in their perusal of an outdoor catalog or magazine. And often people would write in to the companies and say, hey, like, we don't like this. You know, we are in support of women's liberation, and we actually think that this is not the appropriate way to represent them in the outdoors when really they're also athletes. Since that time, I think we've seen a really great expansion in the range of representations for women in the imagery around outdoor sports. And that's in part because of the expansion of who's in the industry, right? The more people on the front end are involved in kind of deciding who the models are, how to take the photographs and how to pose them. Of course, that's going to reshape in very good ways by expanding what the kind of look of the outdoors is. It's hard to get away, though, from those kind of the norm set way back in the 19th century of the rugged white outdoorsman who is kind of the inheritor of the legacy of the frontiersman, right? So kind of steeped both in the kind of like conquest of the West norms as well as these kind of masculinist ideals. And so in some catalogs that I've analyzed from the last couple of decades, I still see invocations of an imagined Old West that don't really want to accept the presence of women kind of in the historical sense, in part because they're trying to promote that image, kind of that heritage for other companies today. So yes, we have come a long way in terms of representation, and that's in part due to the kind of active work that women and men alike have put into to changing that. And I think that as we hold on to kind of within the industry myths about the history, right, the heritage of the industry, that it's going to be hard to let go of those kind of limitations in terms of how women are represented.
Wow. I mean, just what we're talking about right now is truly, I mean, this book is so fascinating on so many levels, but I love how deep you go and how this is really a study of culture and society. I just think it's so cool, set in the context of not just the outdoor industry itself, which can be very insular. And we're all just, you know, we're gazing at ourselves all the time. And, you know, it's us and the pretty, you know, river we're next to are on. But it's just great how you center this in the larger world. And I wonder, how long did you research this book?
I worked on this book for 13 years, so quite a long time.
Wow. 13 years. You were like way ahead of your time. What kicked it off for you?
I mean, I think we'd have to go, you know, way beyond the start of the research for the book. After college, I basically had this fellowship that paid for me to go backpacking around the world, which is an amazing opportunity that I didn't want to pass up. And part of what I learned as I was kind of walking in other countries was how much kind of the stuff I had packed with me that I had taken because I wanted to be warm and safe and dry was based on kind of my cultural expectations about what the right equipment was, not necessarily because it was the best stuff there could be, right? And so, and the people in other countries pointed this out. They asked, oh, why did you pack this? Like, here we use this other object, or here we look a certain way. And it wasn't because I was wrong and they were right, you know, they were right or vice versa. It was actually, oh, there's a history to kind of where I got all my expectations about this is the norm. This is the right way to look in the outdoors. Here's what it feels like to be an expert. And I realized that's what I wanted to explore, where that idea came from. And so when I went back to the US and to graduate school, I basically started with that question of like, how do we understand outdoor culture? And then it was through research and kind of years of study that I started to add to those questions, including things like, you know, what is the role of the companies in shaping consumers like me and our ideas? You know, what are the other cultural and political forces at work that help to shape the development of the industry? So the question started on the trail, right? In the woods, like it does for so many people, you know, like experiences out in the world bring us back to the books. And then it expanded as I realized just how many connections outward a focus on gear and clothing could bring.
Wow. Okay, I have two more questions. Actually, I have like 20 questions, but I have to keep them focused here. So Luis Benitez is how I found out about your book. And he, of course, was the first head of the Colorado Outdoor Recreation Industry Office. And we've had conversations in the past. We're kind of having a conversation right now about, you know, what do we do with this whole idea of the outdoor industry selling nature? And I think it's selling the outdoors. And I feel like your title of your book is kind of, you know, double meaning, right? Like how the outdoor industry sold us what we believed or what it told us we needed to go into the outdoors, and also how it selling out maybe nature. Correct me if I'm wrong, if that was reason in there too, but you know, what do we do? What is your advice, you know, and your takeaway after all this research and after writing this book? Like, what is your message for the North Faces and all the various companies who are just pumping out like the same exact coat as last year, but in this like one shade pink different? What do we do? How do we temper ourselves?
So I think that the first kind of takeaway from all of this research is that I have changed my consumption habits. I still buy gear because I love these activities and I want to participate in them. But what I think I need has narrowed over time as I recognize kind of, you know, as an individual, how much of what kind of my desires are shaped by these broader forces and how much they were about kind of wanting to look the part as much as what I actually needed. So I think that's on the individual level. But your question is kind of how do we scale up those changes in some ways? And I think it's a really tough question. When I serve as a judge for the Innovation Awards for Outdoor Retailer every year, I see people who are kind of facing this question head on in their design of new products in really interesting ways, right? New materials to make products like skis or bike racks, for instance, or new ways of thinking about what to do with running shoes once, you know, we're done, we've pounded them into the ground too many times and they're not useful anymore. I think ultimately, as where we started at the beginning of this conversation, I don't anticipate that the answers are going to come from industry. And I, you know, I'd be curious to hear kind of visions of how that would be possible. But I guess at least in the historical sense, the kind of outdoor industry's kind of interventions here have been here in terms of how to approach consumption responsibly while still actively preserving nature. They have been crucial. They have been kind of pushing the boundaries of what companies can do, especially compared to other industries in this country. And yet it is, in all the historical examples, insufficient, right? The scale of change when you still have a bottom line is really just not enough for what we need to see kind of happen to overturn our system of production and consumption. And so I don't have the answer here. I will say that the historical examples, the kind of research that I've done suggests that likely will not come from companies themselves.
Yeah. Well, Rachel S. Gross, thank you so much for writing your book, Shopping All the Way to the Woods, How the Outdoor Industry Sold Nature to America. I feel like this is one of the most important books I've read this year. I've read some great ones. I just think, you know, we live in Colorado. We love the outdoors. Let's not love it to death. And reading your book is an instruction in, it's a very entertaining instruction in how we got here. And now that we're here, we need to just take a look at ourselves and decide where we're going and do it for the environment. So thank you for joining us.
If that's what readers take away, I will be so delighted. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks for joining us and good luck with everything.
Thanks, Tracy.
You can read more at coloradosun.com. Finally, here are a few stories that you should know about today. Rabbis and faith leaders say Jewish hate continues to rise at a dangerous pace, instilling fear among Jewish Coloradans at home, work, and school. According to recent data released by the Anti-Defamation League, anti-Semitic attacks reported in Colorado in 2023 reached their highest levels in more than four decades and outpaced a nationwide spike. In Colorado, there were 198 incidents last year, compared with 71 in 2022. The ADL said before the October 7th Hamas attack on Israel, anti-Semitic incidents in Colorado were already on pace to hit historic levels, but the war has only compounded targeted hate toward the Jewish community. Colorado communities are getting help from the state to protect their water from wildfires before a fire even happens. The Colorado Water Conservation Board has distributed half of the $10 million for watershed preparedness plans for the year. The first-of-its-kind program helps Coloradans identify which local reservoirs, ditches, roads, and more could be impacted by post-fire problems like debris flows. The goal is to avoid the worst impacts by starting work now. So far, the board has doled out $5.2 million to 19 communities to create plans or start working on them. Colorado will not legalize raw milk this year after a proposal to allow farmers to sell directly to consumers was killed in the state Senate. Colorado has some of the strictest raw milk laws in the West, requiring people to buy shares in a herd if they want to get unpasteurized milk. The bill would have eliminated that workaround. But with concerns over the recent reports of the bird flu virus being found in cows and inactive remnants of the virus in milk, the bill's sponsor said the timing wasn't right for the legislation. He said he might bring it back next year. For more information on all of these stories, visit our website, coloradosun.com. And don't forget to tune in again next time. Now, a quick message from our team.
This is Michael Booth.
And this is John Ingold. We cover health and climate here at the Colorado Sun.
Every week, John and I work together to send out a newsletter to our premium members called The Temperature.
In this newsletter, we share our latest reporting about health and climate and how they intersect. Issues like forever chemicals, healthcare's rising costs, and the lingering effects of the pandemic. The Temperature is one of our weekly newsletters available to members at the premium level.
To sign up, head to coloradosun.com/join. Not only will you be able to sign up for The Temperature and our other premium newsletters, but you'll be supporting the Colorado Sun as a member, and thanks for doing that.